Working Cows Podcast, episode 56.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Cows Podcast, a proud member of the Global Ag Network, which has officially launched this week. Go and check that out at globalagnetwork.com. A whole bunch of great podcasts over there. Head on over to globalagnetwork.com and check out the Global Ag Network, launched this week, brand new, hot off the presses, and we're just so happy to be a part of it. I need to start off with a couple of corrections from last week's solo episode. I had I words on the brain, and I said ionophores a few times in a discussion about turning cow manure from a asset into a liability. Obviously, I was referring to ivermectins and porons and dewormers and those kinds of things. So I just wanted to clear that up as we move forward. Today on the show, we're really excited to welcome back Mary Jo Ehrman. Mary Jo is the author of Farming Without the Bank and Wealth Without the Bank and Wall Street. She was guest on episode number one of the Working Cows podcast, and we're happy to have her back. So Mary Jo Ehrman, welcome back to the Working Cows podcast.
Thank you for having me back.
So as I was driving around today on my way to the office, I heard a report that we are looking at a record soybean harvest in the United States, but also looking at the lowest prices in a decade. And so I know a lot of people who've got these soybeans coming out their ears would love to be able to just put them in a bin for a while and wait for the prices to normalize and wait for this trade war with China to go. And it's no fault of their own, but they are facing lower prices with a record harvest, which isn't always a good combination because higher supply is going to drive down that price. So what is the situation that you are seeing people in as far as their ability to wait and their ability to hold on to those beans when the prices are depressed?
You know, it's the same situation kind of that you heard on the radio. They can't, it depends who they are. Excuse me, and where they're at financially, they might not be able to hold that grain because the bank's going to come a knocking and say, I need that. And what tends to happen is the bank, it's all based on emotion, right? And typically when we're selling commodities, that's based on emotion anyway. And so if we can take the emotion out of it from the banker's side and from the farmer's side and say, hey, Mr. Banker, if you can carry me another 2 or 3 months, I can make more on those beans. But the bank freaks out and the banks are in trouble right now. And so, because we're seeing interest rates go up, land prices, everything's going to start coming down. And so they want that stuff paid off because they need collateral. They don't want just a bunch of assets sitting out there. Banks want cash flow. And so the banks come knocking and say, hey, you need to sell those beans. Even though it's at a low price right now, we don't care if you take a loss, but we can't take the loss. And so that's where a lot of that liquidity and control that I talk about comes into play. Because if we had the liquidity and the control, could we hang on to those beans? And now we would be driving prices, supply versus demand, versus a driven market, a false driven market by the bankers or even by the government, right?
So I'm going to assume that people who are joining us here, workingcows.net/56 is going to be the show notes page. There will be a link to Mary Jo's previous episode, which was number one. Workingcows.net/1 was her first episode, also my first episode. And so So she joined me for the very first episode of the Working Cows podcast just about a year ago now, as we just did our anniversary episode. So you can go there and check out kind of the idea that she's presenting as farming without the bank, the infinite banking concept, and some of those things for a little bit more of a background on those issues. But let's just give a brief overview of what it is you are presenting as a way to resume or wrestle that control back from the banks on your farming operation.
So in the Farming Without the Bank book, really it's just a synopsis of how to get back liquidity control of your money and put that money somewhere where you've got some guarantees and it grows while you use it. And in order to do that, we just use correctly structured dividend paying whole life insurance as the tool to the concept that you mentioned, the infinite banking concept. The life insurance policy is the tool that says, hey, this concept and thought process of liquidity and control, we need something to help with both of those. And that's where the life insurance comes in. But at the end of the day, liquidity and control. And even if you don't use the life insurance policy, if you borrowed money from your savings account or you're operating your entire operation on cash, you're able to sit on those beans and you don't have to pay the bank back. So you have leverage, unlike the guy that's borrowing from the bank.
So there's a brief synopsis. I would encourage you to go check out Mary Jo's book, also linked at the show notes page, workingcows.net/56. I would encourage you to check out that previous episode we did. We talked a little bit more in depth about that. But what I wanted to talk to Mary Jo about today is the responsible use of leverage and some of the risk that's involved that is outside of your control when you are over leveraged. And I think as a person who's fairly convinced of the validity of Austrian economics, a lot of times those things that are beyond our control are actually the intervention of governments in the market. And we have seen at this point the longest boom cycle that has ever happened in the history of the American marketplace. And that has been driven by interest rates that have been kept low by the Federal Reserve. And if you pay attention to the Austrian economists, they will tell you that government intervention in the marketplace throws off the entrepreneur's ability to make responsible, timely investments because they see cheap money in the marketplace and they make long-term investments that cannot be sustained at higher interest rates. And we've seen this happen in the not very distant past, the 1980s, right? We saw lower interest rates, saw people making investments that made sense with lower interest rates. Then the interest rates shot through the roof, and we had the misery index and all those other things. So how do we prepare ourselves for those times of higher interest rates? What can we do to make sure that we are responsibly managing the leverage in our operations to set ourselves up for success?
The first thing we need to do is not overpurchase, right? Because what we saw in the 80s was interest rates were low and banks were just handing money out hand over fist. And go buy this, go buy this, go buy this. And farmers felt as if they should be buying that. Now, we're not necessarily seeing that today anymore. Banks are really pulling back. I mean, where 2-3 years ago, somebody could put down, or 4 or 5 years ago even, somebody could put down 20% down payment to buy some land. Today, banks are asking for 40 to 50% down payments to purchase land. And when the banks are asking for more down payment, so they have more collateral, you as a purchaser have to open your eyes and pay attention to that. They're not solely doing that just so that they're watching your back. They're doing that so that they have enough collateral on the books. If interest rates go up, there is enough collateral on the books that when the bubble bursts and the land prices come down, they still have enough collateral in that piece of land if they want to call that note and say, hey, we're selling that because you need to pay it in full. That is what happened in the 80s. All the interest rate, absolutely, you're right. The interest rates were low. People were buying like crazy until we came in and raised interest rates and the bank didn't have enough collateral. And it was a hard shift. Today, what they're trying to do is a really slow shift. So we don't have a repeat of the 80s. So interest rates are trying to creep up really slow, giving the banks time to react, giving the people that have these loans time to react. So we don't need to put up, and as I watch people expand, we don't want to put up one piece, like just for example, we don't want to put up one quarter of ground for another quarter of ground, because now we've got two quarters collateral for one loan. Higher risk on your side.
So what we're saying here, as I look at farmers, ranchers as entrepreneurs, and entrepreneurs are the key to a thriving economy and entrepreneurs' ability to make smart investments. But low interest rates trick them into making long-term investments that cannot be sustained at higher interest rates. And so we've seen these artificially, as I would say, as an Austrian economist, or not an economist, but somebody who listens to them, artificially low interest rates financed by the Fed's printing of money has tricked some people into making some investments in land in the short term that won't be sustainable with lower commodity prices and some of those things. And I guess I see us, and I've heard it from other people, not necessarily people who are even interested in Austrian economics, that are looking at where we're headed and saying this smells a lot like the 80s. Where we're at right now smells a lot like the 80s. And so we need to start making sure that we are in a place where we are responsibly using that leverage so that we aren't caught with our pants down if the interest rates do come back up.
Exactly. If interest rates come back up, some notes are going to get called, and we are, and if they come up fast, we're going to have, and commodity prices stay low, we're going to have a repeat of the 80s. So then we have to look at who's going to be buying. I just watched a video of the 1980s farm crisis, and they were having sheriff auctions is what they call them. And so you watch that and you see just devastation across the board. But then you go, who was buying? Somebody was buying, and they were buying at, and you can't even really call it a discounted rate because it was inflated to begin with, right? So they were buying at the correct value at that time, a discounted rate. So who's going to have the opportunity to buy when these interest rates come back? The guy with liquid money.
I've been listening to these guys for 2 years now, and it makes a lot of sense to me. Some of the guys I've been listening to, Tom Woods, Bob Murphy, they've got a podcast called Contra Krugman. Bob Murphy also has a podcast with Carlos Lara, the Lara Murphy Report. Peter Schiff, another guy that talks a lot about these things. And he said, you know, President Trump campaigned well. He was talking about a big, ugly bubble. But then as soon as he's President Trump, he starts to take credit for the best economy since sliced bread. And now he's got himself painted into a corner where he can't, if he took credit for the upswing, he's also going to be responsible for the downturn. That's a problem. Mm-hmm. We should have, according to Peter Schiff, we should have gone through the difficulty. We should have kept calling it a big, ugly bubble, and we should have dealt with the pain of the higher interest rates that we need to get everything back to, as you said, those prices were inflated. We mm-hmm. need to get everything back to a reasonable price structure, and so that we can start to operate closer to real. We can't operate on a real price structure and without gold backing up our money supply, but we're getting way into the weeds there. So, but we need to get back to something like a real interest rate structure, and a Fed-financed 0% interest rate is not a real thing. And so we need to make sure that we are figuring out ways to get liquidity back into our system. And what do we mean by liquidity when we talk about that? What do we say in when we talk about liquidity?
When I talk about liquidity, I mean cash on hand. And I just talked about this with a farmer a couple weeks ago. And we actually argued about it a little bit because he's like, well, I have liquidity. I have, 90% of my land paid for. I have liquidity. So that's not liquid. You have to go to the bank for it. Well, the bank will lend me the money. They always do. I go, until they don't. Liquidity means access to cash right now without having to ask for it. So is that cash value of your life insurance? Is that a savings account? Is that an IRA or a 401k? Is it a bond? Is something that can be liquefied immediately? And typically even your IRAs, any kind of mutual fund isn't even that liquid. And you don't really know how much you have until you get the check. Because today it's one amount, in an hour it could be another amount. That's going to depend on the market. But as a farmer, do you want assets or do you want cash flow? What is more important? And assets are great, and paid off assets are wonderful. But in addition to paying off those assets, we need to create a pool of money that we have immediate access to, and we can take advantage of situations when the time is right. We can take advantage of a situation that somebody has overpaid for land, interest rates go high, now that land is for sale and we're going to get it at a much better price. The guys with liquid, immediate access to cash have that. And when times are bad and the banks aren't lending money, the liquidity disappears against your asset.
And the value of the asset crashes too, right?
Yep,
or at least
absolutely,
it goes back to normal, as we would say. Mm-hmm. It doesn't crash. It goes back to what it should have been all along.
And exactly. Yep.
That land should only be valued at what it's able to produce, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
That land should only be valued at what it's able to produce when commodities are at a reasonable value. And so when you have 90% of your land paid for, but your land is 50% overvalued, you don't have as much liquidity as you might think you do. And so when things crash and you go to sell that land and it was 50% overvalued at high commodity prices, then it's not as valuable as you thought it was. And you are in a position where you can't take advantage of those lower land prices around you as well as you thought you could, because your land isn't worth what you thought it was. So cash on hand is an important tool in your tool bag to take advantage of lower land prices around you and be ready right now to take advantage of that. What do you see as the way that most farmers and ranchers handle these situations? Are they just always leveraged as much as they can be, buying land as soon as it comes available because it's next to them or it's within a reasonable distance that they can make it work? What do you see mostly on operations that you are working with?
And most of the people that I work with are pretty responsible with their money, or they wouldn't really be called. They don't really call because they just don't have anything. So they're not completely leveraged. I mean, there are some that are leveraged, and there are some of them that I just can't do anything with because they are so leveraged. And that gets into the whole point of whose responsibility is it to run your operation? Is it the banks? Is it the accountants? Or is it yours? Who signs off on the check? And so as happened through the 80s, these bankers came in and said, hey, I'll give you whatever you want. And in that video, you'll see some of the farmers go back and say, well, the banker made me buy it. And we saw some of that when corn prices were, $6, $7 a bushel, right? The banker made me buy it. And I call your BS on that. Did the banker make you buy it? Did the banker sign your check for you? Did he forge your name? Or did you sign that check and you bought it based on high corn prices or high commodity prices? The people that are not leveraged to the hilt, I talked to a guy yesterday. They are operating everything on cash. It's really remarkable. And I said, well, when are your payments going to end on your equipment? And he said, oh, so in 3 years, he won't have one single payment left. Because he bought when prices were high, but he didn't buy brand new. He bought used equipment. He didn't overpay for it. And so maybe he did a little bit at that point, but it's not like he bought brand new and he couldn't make his payments. So he's been able to make his payments because they've been low payments. He did it based on, hey, if corn's not going to stay at $6.25 or $7 a bushel, I can still make those payments at $3.25 a bushel. And so we have to look at whose responsibility is it to look at our numbers, do your accounting, keep your books, make sure that you understand your numbers. Because if you don't understand your numbers, when commodity prices go to hell and interest rates go high, who's going to be caught in the crossfire? You. Because at the end of the day, the banker's telling you to take a loan because he's making interest money and he's got some cash flow that he can be turning money 10 times, right? John Deere Financial is actually turning money 30 times because they can. And so is John Deere Financial actually helping you out, or are they hurting you? They're causing inflation because they're turning money even more than a bank can turn money. And so you really have to look at, you have to protect you. And unfortunately, I understand that you're the farmer and you're not, God probably didn't create you to do books, but he created somebody to do books. So find that person to do those books so that you know exactly where you're at. And pay attention to them. You don't have to study them constantly, but pay attention to them and don't let the banker or the accountant run your operation. You run the operation.
We talk a lot about on the Working Cows podcast, taking the emotion out of the decision-making process when it comes to this cow. Yeah, she raised a 700-pound calf 2 years ago, but she's open this year. Fertility mm-hmm. drives the bus. I'm going to make the t-shirt. It's coming. So you can't make an emotional decision about that cow raised a big calf once, so I'm going to keep her around so that she can raise another, because if she's open 1 year, she has to go. And so we need to figure out a way to take the emotion out of these decisions that we have to make, or we're not going to be able to make smart business decisions. And so, yeah, that newer tractor is shinier. And maybe has some other features that are really nice, but if it doesn't make sense at low commodity prices, it probably shouldn't make sense at high commodity prices. What are some of the strategies you see people employing that are doing it well? Give me some examples of people that you are working with that have a good strategy in place that are set up well for lower land prices and ready to take advantage of those things that they see.
The one I just mentioned that, you know, he bought everything based on lower commodity prices. He was smart about it. I have a few farmers that are doing either all nat, like I have one hog farmer, he's doing all natural hogs. It doesn't change his operation any. It's just that he can sell his product for more because it's all natural. He can still vaccinate them. He just has to feed them non-GMO food. I have one farmer that's growing non-GMO corn. He's making a lot more money than the average corn grower because he's putting in non-GMO, but he can put pretty much the same fertilizer and chemicals on. And so it's just a different seed. You've got some diversification going on. Some of those farmers are actually diversifying the farm. They're doing other things with it. Maybe they're poultry farmers and they're hauling out chicken litter and they're selling chicken litter to another farmer to use as fertilizer. And so right now, a lot of that, and I'm actually going to start doing interviews with farmers that have some diversification on the farm. that we can't today in the with the commodity prices the way they are and the land prices as high as they are, we can't just do one thing anymore. We might have to use that farm for some other method. But we're not even, those people that are getting ahead aren't, they're waiting, they're listening to podcasts like yours, Clay. They're waiting for the bubble to burst before they buy anything. They're not overextending themselves and they're doing okay. And because they knew that the times were coming, they didn't buy into this false inflation. Or they remember the 80s, perhaps. But we have a younger generation that is in their mid-20s to mid-30s, that they didn't truly hear how bad the 80s were. And even though they may know about them, they didn't truly know how bad they were. They didn't know what really caused it. And so I think that bringing that education back will open their eyes a little bit. And that's exactly what you're doing with your podcast, opening people's eyes to the fact that this is inflation. Inflation is not that my bag of Oreos is smaller. And that darn Walmart, they're charging me more money for that smaller bag of Oreos. It's not Walmart's fault, and it's not Nabisco's fault. It's ultimately the Fed's fault for printing all this money. And it takes Nabisco more money to create those Oreos. It takes Walmart more money to pay their workers to have their building, to have those Oreos on the shelf. It pays more money to have the trucker come in and deliver them and the fuel to get there. So you look at all these things and go, oh my gosh, that is inflation. It's the devaluing of the dollar, not the increased cost of the product.
Purchasing power. We're losing purchasing power, and that's the right. Primary way that the Federal Reserve steals money from people is that, mm-hmm. I had $50,000 in the bank when I retired, but that $50,000 barely buys me a pickup now when it used to buy, a quarter of land or something. That's what we're talking about when we talk about the Federal Reserve and what they've done to the purchasing power of our money. And so, how are people using your concept or Nelson Nash's concept of the infinite banking concept and dividend paying whole life insurance? How are they using that as part of their strategy to give themselves freedom and control?
We're moving some of that debt that would be held at the bank, and we're moving that debt into their life insurance policy that's held under their control. So now if I have a $500,000 combine and I finance that through my life insurance policy, I have that control. So if commodity prices drop, interest rates go up, I can make an interest only payment and I don't have to make a payment back to myself because my death benefit is collateral to that loan. It's not hitting my balance sheet. We're keeping the bank out of the equation. It's just a lot cleaner. It's a lot less stressful because right now farmers are under a lot of stress. We're seeing increased suicide rates and it's sad. I just want to make that statement. It's very, very sad. But at the end of the day, I'm always a problem solver, right? So I'm like, well, why did that guy commit suicide and how many people could have he called? But what is the solution to the problem? And if we go to the problem, it's finances. Or they're scared that the finances are driving the emotions based on, I've lost the family farm that's three generations old and I'm the failure, right? But the failure came from the lack of finances. So can we move some of that over? A lot of what we're doing as well, Clay, is not just carrying that debt in there, but making sure that the older generation is handing off some death benefit to the younger generation so they have money to operate and they don't have to go through these same struggles because we're losing family farms, but we're losing family farms because of finances. It's not that our kids are lazy and that they don't want to farm. These kids want to farm. They grew up there, their heart's there. It's in your blood, but they can't farm on blood, sweat, and tears. That's just not like you did it. The older generation did it and kudos to you, but the younger generation is saying, I'm not going there and I'm not going there without a plan. So if you're not going to plan, you tell me why I should stay and do it because you did it. That doesn't work anymore. There has to be a plan. And so what I'm seeing a lot and what I'm actually doing a lot is I'm writing a lot of life insurance on mom and dad, and we're buying about a dollar a death benefit for about 45 to 50 cents income tax free. So when mom and dad pass away, that younger generation is going to get a dollar that they paid 50 cents for income tax free to either buy out siblings, to use for operating, to do whatever with. That was not ever in the plan before. Before the 80s, we saw a lot of life insurance and estate planning for farms, and we just don't see that anymore today.
And when you get beyond that second generation, or the first generation, depending on how you look at it, if the first generation is the son or daughter that's paying for the life insurance policy and getting a dollar of death benefit for 45 cents of investment, you go to the second generation then, the son or daughter's mm-hmm. children, and they're able to buy it at an even more discounted rate, right?
Absolutely. Yep. I have a blog post on my website, farmingwithoutthebank.com, and it's called the Generational Wealth blog post. It's generational wealth that will save the family farm. And I actually ran strategies, and I have it on there, that if a 60-year-old bought $20,000 worth of insurance, $20,000 of premium, they would pass off $671,000 of death benefit. If the next generation rolled that into life insurance, we took $671,000 and we turned it into $2.3 million for the end of the second generation, right? So the third generation inherits $2.7 million. They put that into life insurance. We turn that into $11.6 million. So by the fourth generation is inheriting $11.6 million. We've paid 18 cents for every dollar of death benefit income tax free. We've used it income tax free. It grew income tax free. And if that third generation passes it to the fourth, or if the fourth generation rolls it into more life insurance, they'll be passing on $44 million income tax free. Now, when we ask what the wealthy do, what do the Rockefellers do? They buy life insurance on every new person in their family, and it goes into a trust, and they just keep rolling money. Why aren't we doing that? Why aren't we rolling money so the next generation is better? Why aren't we figuring out how to save what we work so hard to build? Because we get up every day and we work our butt off, but we don't look into the future far enough to figure out how to save it and how to make it a little bit more comfortable for the next generation. And we're not leaving them rich, because with the rate of inflation and the cost to do business and farming, they're not going to be rich by any stretch of the imagination. But they might be able to expand. They might be able to keep up what you built.
What are some of the opportunities for the first and second generation as they're using this process? What are some of the things that people who are just getting started out doing? Does one generation just have to commit to putting in the seed money and letting it grow, or is there some opportunity for the earlier generations to also benefit from this process?
No, the immediate generation that's doing it, they're benefiting right away because they immediately have access to cash. So we can immediately start moving some of that debt away from the bank into their own life insurance policy. They immediately have some liquidity and some control. They have some guarantees. They might be the first generation is going to also possibly be using that for retirement. Because right now there's not a farmer out there planning for retirement. Outside of, oh, I'm going to sell this to the kids and that's my retirement, or I'm going to rent it to the kids and that's my retirement income. And so can we use the life insurance policy as our retirement? So there's absolutely, I mean, if you're buying cows, so the first generation that's starting this, we're going to buy cows with it. You know, we're going to put that money in and we're going to start building our herd or buying some cows or bulls or fencing or tractors or whatever you want to do, down payments for land. It's definitely useful while you're alive. We do not have to just sit on it and wait.
The only cure for inflation is higher interest rates, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So what are the interest rates on this strategy, and how do we make sure that we're in a good place when the interest rates do start to normalize?
Interest rates right now with the company that I write for are 4.76. There are companies, so right now most companies are anywhere between 4.5 to 8. So people ask me this question all the time. What if interest rates go higher? What's the life insurance company going to do? So I have a twofold answer to that. One, if we read Becoming Your Own Banker by R. Nelson Nash, you will see in there that Nelson was borrowing money against his life insurance policies at 5, 6, and 8% in the 80s. When the banks were at 24, Nelson was paying 5, 6, and 8%. So do you anticipate the life insurance companies going higher than that today? I don't. There's regulations on how much they can increase per year, and that is about 0.5% per year. So it's going to take them a really long time to get to 24% if that would happen again, or even 20%. Now, what if they did? Let's say that the feds put a 20% rate on the bank stuff again, and all of a sudden the banks are charging us 20% and the life insurance company is charging us 20%. Who do you want to have a 20% loan with? Yourself or the bank? I would rather have that loan with myself and have control of it and say, oh, I can pay that back if I can, or I don't have to pay that back if I can. I would much rather have that loan with myself. So we really have to be logical about it and not just go, oh, it's just a rate, and get so hooked on the rate. Where do you want that money? I mean, right now, even you can get a 2% car loan rate at our local bank. So do you go to the life insurance policy at 4.76? Probably not. Unless you absolutely want control of that loan to say, I don't know if I'm going to make my payment because times are tough and I'm an entrepreneur. Then yeah, I want that loan from the bank, or I want that loan from my policy. Sorry. But otherwise, I might just take advantage of the 2% loan rate at the bank and leave that money in my policy for another opportunity because it's liquid money.
Yep. Use the cheap money if you've got the liquid assets to back it up. Use the cheap money while it's available. And then when, I'm not going to say if, I will say when interest rates go high, you have access to real money, liquid assets that you can get to through your planning of being your own banker. And that's why this process is so attractive, and I think such a game changer for people who want to start to have some more control and not have to, as you said in the first podcast, buy the ranch, buy the farm back from the bank every single generation.
Now, Nelson would reprimand me for saying that you should go to the bank at 2%, because you're still allowing the bank to turn money. You're still allowing the feds to turn money. And that is not an Austrian school of thought. The Austrian school of thought is you put your money in the policy and you use the policy no matter what the interest rate is on the policy, because you own that company, because it's a mutual company. So you own part of it. So why would you go to the bank and borrow their money? That's like stealing the peas, as Nelson would call it. However, if you don't care about the Austrian school of thought and you need to leverage yourself a little bit, you can do it that way. Now, you know, if you want to get rid of the banks and you want to do what Carlos and Robert are talking about, and Carlos and Robert really talk a lot about the 10% tipping point. And the fact that if we used infinite banking and we use the life insurance policies along with two of their other methods, because they have a three system approach to it. So if you used infinite banking and we removed ourselves from the banks, 10% of us did that, government would be cut in half and there would be no Federal Reserve. So if you want to be part of that 10% movement, then don't use the 2% bank money. Don't use the banks at all. But it takes us time to get there. So in that meantime, we might have to do that. We might have to still go to the bank and say, you know what, I'm going to need both of them.
We're going to wean ourselves off of it though, right?
Right. Right.
Half the government should mean half the tax burden too, right?
Well, I would hope so, gosh.
Yeah, no, I'm
Nelson, I don't know. Did you know this, Clay? Nelson does not, he does not believe in taking a child deduction. He does not believe in taking a mortgage deduction. And he has tried to have them not pay him Social Security because he firmly believes, and he's right? Let's think about this, but he firmly believes that if you take a deduction, you are part of the problem. Because in order for the government to give us a deduction, we have to pay in taxes.
So here's how I rationalize it. If I don't pay those taxes, they come to my house with a gun and take it from me, right? So I rationalize it by saying that I should get some benefit from it. But consistency is Nelson's position. I will say that is true. But as a young guy trying to get started out, I have rationalized it in that way. So
I totally understand that. And if Nelson were here, he would say, but you're the problem. So if 10% of us quit rationalizing it, would we see the movement? And there's not getting to that 10% is the hard part, because I'm with you. I'm like, gosh, I'm going to use that 2% money because I want to leverage my money. I want to keep it liquid. I don't want to tie it up into a piece of tin. I want to keep it liquid so that when there's an opportunity, when these interest rates go up and housing market comes back down, I have an opportunity to buy some rental property, or I have an opportunity to buy some land.
So what we're trying to do here today is to whet some appetites, to hopefully pique some interest that people could go out and look at getting started in this system themselves. So where should we send them?
FarmingWithoutTheBank.com is always a great start. I do ask that anybody that meets with me, they read the book first. They either read Farming Without the Bank, they read Wealth Without the Bank or Wall Street, another book that I've authored since I've been on the show, or Nelson's Becoming Your Own Banker. Any of those books are good. They're going to give you a great idea of what the concept is, how it works, and how the thought process around money is going to change.
And Mary Jo's referenced a couple of times a video that we will have linked at the show notes page as well, workingcows.net/56, links to Mary Jo's website, Mary Jo's book, Nelson's book, all that will be there at workingcows.net/56. Also, there's some other good resources, the Laura Murphy Report. So we will have links to all that at the show notes page at workingcows.net/56. Mary Jo, I appreciate your time again today, and thank you for taking the time. I look forward to those interviews that are coming.
Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Super excited. One of the guests that I've wanted to have on for quite a while. Actually, it was a suggested guest from one of the very earliest episodes. It is Nicolette Han Nyman will be joining me for episode number 57 of the Working Cows podcast next week. We will see you then for episode 57 of the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.